Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. That would be Mr. Briscoe. I would be Bradshaw. And if you built a Mount Rushmore, you always talk about it in sports, about who's going to be on it. If you built one for referees and professional wrestling, this man is on it. And everybody's Mount Rushmore. And I want to have a little disclaimer here. James Beard, who I'm talking about, Texas Hall of Famer, Cauliflower Alley Club Hall of Famer. He's the one that originally hired me in Dallas, sent me to Japan for the first time. And Mr. Briscoe, Gerald Briscoe, who shares stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw, he's the one that hired me in WWE. So for all of you that are mad about that, it's these two gentlemen's fault right here that I'm in the wrestling business. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, John, how you doing, man?
James, welcome to the show. I've already apologized to the WWE universe for a mistake. Everybody's entitled to one mistake, right, in their career. And, you know, we're looking at mine. So I apologize. But it all boils down to where it's your fault.
So this is why we've had heat all these years, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. James, tell me, you saw this guy. I mean, you know, walking in from Abilene Christian, where, by the way, he is in the Football Hall of Fame there. And we were very proud of JBL for that accomplishment, and was named, you know, one of their best all time, I think, of the last five centuries or something like that. He goes back a long ways. But I know he listened to his story. The great Dallas Sportatorium, that was world famous arena back in his day there. And that's probably where you got your start too. But do you remember when this long Yankee, probably really pimple faced guy, walked into the Sportatorium and said, "I want to be a wrestler"?
I remember it very well. Yeah. I was sitting in the booking office with Akbar, and I think Manny Fernandez might have been in there too. I don't remember, but we were sitting there talking about the TV. It was on Friday night. We were going to shoot TV that night, we lost our main event. The guy I can't remember who it was supposed to be. I guess Rod Price. Rod Price was our champion.
It was Lou Perez. Al Perez is working.
Okay, I couldn't remember who it was, but I can remember that they were supposed to be there, and for whatever reason, they were going to show up. And we were talking about that, trying to fill that hole, thinking about what we were going to do that night, and to hear a knock on the door, and it was just in the middle of the afternoon. And go after the door, and there was this tall, long, blonde-haired guy standing there, you know. he says, "Hey, I'm John Layfield. I'm looking for a job."
and there's your main event,
it's just like that simple. You know, he walked in, we'd sit down to talk to him, and we found out that he'd been training with Brad Redington, and you know, we figured if he'd been training with Brad, he probably knew a little bit anyway. And we talked a little while, and we thought, well, you know, what the hell, and we just threw him in there. And the deal was, you know, I get in the ring with him, and if he's the shits, then I tell Rod, pin him. It's over with, you know. And if he's okay, then, you know, we've got a big guy that maybe we can do something with, and just let it go for 20 minutes or so. And that's what happened. He got in the ring, and I could tell, you know, right off, he had at least knew how to get through a match. And so we went about 20 or 30 minutes or so with Rod, and that's how it started. And, you know, from there on, we were just like that, you know.
In my first real match, Jerry, I get down there just looking for a job, and they go, we got a spot for Rod Price. And I've been watching TV, and I thought, well, that's the champion. I thought, what am I doing? The champion? I'm on last in the main event. And they don't tell me anything. I mean, they tell me, you know, Rod's going over, but I'm sure that's what it was, but they don't tell me anything. Well, how long are we going? And James, like, we're not sure.
No, we're not sure about that.
Yeah.
That's the thing. That's the thing. A lot of people, they don't realize the importance of a great referee inside that ring. And they don't really know what all his job entails. And that night, your job was not only to count one, two, three, but your job was an evaluation job.
Absolutely.
And to kind of whisper in John's ear, you know, where to go with the match and everything. And having a great referee and having a real ring general in there is so important to any match. Any great match that's ever been produced has a great referee in that ring with it leading the way there. So, James, I know your hard work being in the ring. all those years. And I can't tell you how many times referees save my ass when you have those just those metal blackouts and you don't know what to do next. You know, somebody like Layfield slaps you up the head and all your thoughts go out. And say, I'm going to beat the shit out of that guy. So what do I do next? You know, and then you always turn to the referee. Help, what do I do? Right.
You know, that happened a lot back in those days when we actually worked matches, you know, but now they have everything laid out, and it's, you know, if something goes wrong, it's just gone. It's just a mess. But in those days, at least you could get out of things like that because you had somebody in there that knew how to get you out of it. And right. and having a referee in there that knows how to do that made a big difference to those guys. You know, I'm sure I'm glad to hear you say that because a lot of people don't appreciate that these days.
Well, it's just experience of being saved so many times by so many referees. Of course, we had the legendary Stu Swartz down here, you know, one of the greatest of all time.
And, great ones.
And also Sonny Myers, who was not only a great performer, but turned out to be a great referee because he knew the issue that the talent had to deal with while they were in the ring. So Sonny was right there, too. There's just been a plethora of great referees, not only here in Florida, but all over the country. And they're as John knows, they're so valuable to each and every successful match.
There's a real trust factor there too that a lot of people don't understand. You know that you have to develop with guys. You know that, well, I was very lucky being at the Sportatorium for so many years, and the guys knew me, and they knew that if I said something, that I was just trying to help them along. You know, and that was my goal, to make the match better.
Not only was you an outstanding referee, but you had so many roles there at the Sportatorium for world class wrestling. Just name some of the other titles. I know you helped with the matchmaking, the booking, and all that stuff. And
developing
talent and the kind of a policeman on the road, trying to keep guys like Layfield on the straight and narrow.
Well, you know, that's actually true. That all of those things kind of came into play over the years. And you know, when you first start out, you're just trying to get accepted. And once that happens, and you start beginning to get to a point to where the guys trust you and understand that you know your job and you're going to do the job the way it's supposed to be done. And then everything changes. Then they start coming to you for things, and the office even comes to you for things. And I was, for a lot of years, I was a guy that was kind of the go-between the office and the talent, you know, where the office says, okay, I want this finish and I want this to happen. And you go to the talent and you go like, I know he's not going to like this, you know? And so you got to find a way to tell them, you know, in a way that they can accept it or go back to the office to say, hey, he said he how about doing it this way? And then you become kind of a negotiator in those situations sometimes. So it's a lot of things get involved in being a referee, more than just in the ring. And I was lucky enough to get to that point. And I really kind of enjoyed that role.
And one of the things
is basically is that trust factor, as you said earlier, you know, that the office got to trust you that you're delivering the right messages.
Right.
And the talent's got to accept your word too. So you develop that trust with the talent, and you're three quarters away home, and then you know, the rest of it's just dealing with the office. But it's an awesome responsibility, and you know, there's a lot of referees, but there's a few great ones, and you're right up there with well, on that Mount Rushmore referees, as John said earlier.
Well, thank you, Jerry. That means a lot to me. It really does. You know,
Jerry, one thing about trust was the office trusted James so much. You know, I worked with some great referees. I've always said James is the best referee I've ever worked with, and I have a lot of love for the Hebners, for Kyoto Corderas. Nick Patrick, I think, could also call a match, for, you know, like James could do, but I never was in that role with Nick to do that. Mickey Henson was a great referee, but Skandar Akbar had such confidence in James. It was one of the few referees I've ever been able to do this. Now, like I say, Nick Patrick would probably do it too, but I didn't ever saw him in that role. Is Akbar would send out a really young guy with a veteran, and he could rely on James to help call the match for the young guy. So James would tell him not to jive. James would tell him what to do. James would be his instructor in the ring. And Akbar had so much trust in James that he had a lot more flexibility with his roster because of that. And that's something I always thought James was just an amazing thing. I've never seen anybody else be able to do it, to call a match as the referee.
Well, and you know, and even with experienced guys, sometimes if you feel something and you think maybe this will work, then I would try to suggest things. I never felt like I was trying to actually call their match for them, but I always wanted to try to insert things if I felt like something, hey, maybe this will work. I can say this, you know, try this. But at the same time, I kind of learned, I learned a lesson one time over in Japan about another part of that that you have to think about, and that's making sure that the talent you're working with understands that that's what you're doing. You know, I was in the ring one time with Rick Martel, the first time I'd ever worked with him over there. Great wrestler, great guy. Worked with him many times after this, but we were in there and I felt something, and I had been used to doing that over there even. And I said, you know, how about this? And Rick looked at me kind of like with daggers, you know, like you're the referee, you don't call the match, you know. And I'm like, oh, you know. So I just shut up, and we got through the match, and after it was all over with, we're back in the dressing room, and Rick walked up to me and he says, you know, he said, I'm sorry I snapped at you. He said after you said that, I thought that's exactly what I should have done. and you know, I said, well, I appreciate that, but I learned a lesson there that those guys have to trust you too, yeah, and know you well enough that you're just trying to help them along too. Even the guys that were as great as Rick was.
Hey, Jay, you're seeing a totally different picture than what we as talent see. You're seeing the big picture where we're just seeing that little tussle there we're going through at the time, but you're able to see that big picture there. And you know, it takes a hell of a man, and I've seen guys exactly like Martel, only, you know, kind of referee comes in, why the hell you tell me what to do in my match? Well, I'm sitting over there thinking, man, because he knows more than you.
Yeah. Well, to Rick's credit, he admitted after, he said, you know, that's exactly what I should have done. It just took me by surprise when you said that. I wasn't used to it. And I said, well, you know, if you don't want me to say anything, I won't say anything. He said, no, that's okay. I know now, you know.
Hey, James, you were singing music, playing music all over Dallas. You have great musical talent.
Yeah.
For anybody that knows,
thank you.
Knows that. And then you got into refereeing by your contacts you made through the music industry, guys coming in to listen to you sing, things like that. So you're like Jerry Briscoe and I. You've never had a real job, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, you can put it that way, yeah.
So which was wilder? You know, back in the 80s, people don't know about the 80s that didn't live the 80s. You know, Michael Hayes says he can't remember the 80s, which probably is true. I love Michael.
But did Michael remember them?
The 80s was so crazy.
He has a slight memory loss. It's the decade of the 80s.
Yeah, I could remind him of a few things.
I bet you can. Let's hear some of them.
Which was wilder, the music or the wrestling?
Which was what?
Wilder. Which was wilder?
Oh, wow. Honestly, in my case, definitely the wrestling. Definitely the wrestling. The music was it was fun. I enjoyed it. It was kind of my first love, and I still do some of that. But yeah, as far as being wild and crazy, no question about that. The wrestling is the craziest.
You started the Sportatorium in 85, I believe it was, you know, right at the kind of the peak toward the end of the, you know, the initial really hot period of the Von Erich.
Yeah, I missed the goody part at first, yeah.
Who was Booker then?
Gary.
Gary Hart?
Yeah.
What was the heat with Gary and Fritz? I mean, Gary had worked with Fritz since the 60s. I mean, this was a long-running feud on television, but it was a feud behind scenes, too. They really didn't like each other, right?
Well, it was kind of a love-hate relationship. Fritz liked to blame Gary for a lot of things that the boys did.
Funny you do that. You blame the Booker.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and the truth is that Gary was kind of like a knuckle to him. You know, he kind of treated him that way. And I don't think Gary really adversely influenced those guys in any way. You know, like Fritz was trying to insinuate. But that was part of it, and part of it would be that you know, Gary would want to do a certain thing, and like a typical promoter owner. even though Fritz had been a great star himself, he'd insert his opinion in there, and sometimes that opinion didn't jive with what Gary wanted to do, and you know, it was one of those kinds of things where he hated him, but he loved him at the same time, I think.
Gary was a very unique cat back in his days. You know, he was legit tough guy too. You know, a lot of people look at Gary. I mean, Gary come from the streets of Chicago, and you know, he grew up. He even got in the business a little rough way. You know, with some shady type people, and he had to leave Chicago, and I think he went to Texas, you know, just to get away from that element down there. So Gary was a guy that was very strong in his opinion. I was so fortunate when I was very beginning, when I was in a loop with Gary from Australia to Carolina to Florida to Georgia. But just sitting under that learning tree, and I become great friends with him and his wife Twinkle, and I'd go to dinner with him all the time. But what a wonderful person. But man, Gary was he had his opinions, and he was going to express them, whether, you know, Vern or Fritz or Eddie or Crockett or whoever, Gary Art was going to express his opinions.
And that's where the problem would start a lot of times, because Fritz was a very stubborn, hard-headed guy himself, and they would butt heads over certain things, and they had that love-hate relationship. And I considered Gary a mentor myself. He was a guy I learned a lot from. And we were good buddies and friends up until the day he died, and I loved being around him. He was so smart and just always knew what to do, but in the right situations. I guess when I get involved in the creative side of things, a lot of what I do comes from the things I learned from Gary Hart.
And you had quite a few guys there, James, that were really wrestling brainiacs. I mean, you had Michael Hayes, who's just coming in, who to me is just the guy's a genius, man. He can put together a 6-month scenario in his head on the spot. You had Fritz, who was also very good. You know, did you realize how good that territory was? No, I mean, not just hot, but they had like 6-camera shoot. They had mic'd up the rings. They were really ahead of a lot of different people because of the production that they did. Did you realize at the time that this territory is head and shoulders better than a lot of others? Maybe not the best, but head and shoulders better than a lot of those around in Texas.
I'm not sure that everybody kind of realized it on that level. I think that we knew that there was a lot of cutting edge things going on production wise that you don't see in other, I mean, it's very obvious. You see some TV here and TV there, and then watch what World Class was doing. And it was different. You know, it was kind of the precursor to what Vince ended up doing. You know, he turned it into something beyond just a black and white, plain old blah type event. You know, it turned into something that was really, really an event for people to watch on TV show on Saturday night or whatever, Sunday morning or whatever it was. And it was obvious that was different. As far as everything else goes, you know, there were great territories that, I mean, Jerry was home base down there in Florida. My goodness, you know, it didn't get any better than that. You look at the guys, but then a lot of those guys came to Texas. You know, sometimes you'd see those guys in Florida, and then the next thing you know, they'd be in Texas. So you got a little bit of the same kind of thing there. So as far as the wrestling goes, it was beyond just the Von Erichs and the Freebirds. You know, there was a plethora of talent there that was doing things all up and down the lineup, and it was very special for a while.
Yeah, one of the guys that we left out of this conversation is the great Skandor Akbar. When my brother Jack first broke into business around 1965, late 65, Skandor was a rookie too. And of course, they traveled together. And during spring breaks and during holidays and everything, I'd go over to my brother's house, I'd jump in the back seat of that car. And these two rookies, I'd listen to their philosophy on what was going on. And granted, they're both rookies at the time, but both of those guys had really, really sharp business minds and was saying what we need to do. You know, this is the mid-60s, what the business needs to do to elevate to the next level. Skandor was always full of ideals, and I'd sit there with my mouth open, just listen to every word he had to say. So I wasn't around him after he developed that skill. I moved on, and he moved on to Texas. I moved on to Florida and other places. But I was always just really thrilled when I'd see Skandor or Akbar on the top of a card or hear him, because I was there when he was first starting out. But he had that business mind from the very beginning, and he helped influence me and my brother Jack so much during our rookie learning years. You know, I think it helped Jack to go on and become a world champion.
I learned so much. I can't even tell you how much I learned just riding in the car with Skandor Akbar. And I rode thousands and thousands of miles with him, and learned so much just listening to him and just talking with him and picking up. I tell guys all the time when I do clinics and things that I probably learn more listening than I ever learned in the ring. And a lot of guys can't understand that, but I really believe that's true. I think I learned more about my job and how to do my job by listening than I did just actually working in the ring. And guys like Skandor was a huge part of that.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's missing a lot now because these guys fly rather than drive, you know. Sitting in that back seat when you're young, and even when you got a few years on you, you know, sitting in that back seat listening is the key to growing in this business. And it's hard to do when you're sitting next to somebody on an airplane. You got almost be screaming at each other to hear, you know. But Skandor, I mean, you listen to 10 minutes of that guy, you knew that his future was going to be bright in the business, and that turned out to be a bright star.
And I can tell you a little story about that too. I had the first time I went to a Cauliflower Alley was in New Jersey, and that was back in 95 or 96. I can't remember now exactly what year it was, but Red Bastine was a very good friend of mine, and another guy I considered a mentor, and a guy I learned an awful lot from. So he got me to go to this thing, and the next morning I got there one day. The next morning I got up, went to breakfast with Red, and I'm sitting there with Red Bastine, Gorilla Monsoon, and Lou Thesz at the breakfast table.
Wow!
You know, so pretty heavy company, you know.
They pay a fortune to do that, James. For good reason.
And so somewhere in the conversation, Akbar's name came up, and excuse me, that's Wild Bill Irwin trying to call me. I'll have to call him back.
Big money.
Put him on, man. Put him on.
Bill Irwin was the bike. James, I don't mean to cut you off, but Wild Bill Irwin is probably calling you to tell you about his bad payoff he got. I love Bill. You know how much I love Bill. Bill, we can have a sold out house. He goes, we're probably going to get stuff on the payoff. There was always something there.
Never happy about Bill. Anything. Yeah. Anyway, get back to the story. Sorry, Bill. Getting back to the story. I'm sitting there with these three legends, right? You know, and Axe's name came up, and Lou started talking about Ack, and I didn't realize at the time, but Lou had a lot of influence on Ack getting started in the business and training him and all that. And he just went on and on and on about Akbar wrestling, not the manager part, the wrestling. And I came away from that with a completely different appreciation for Ack's skills, you know, and his status, because there is Lou Thesz, you know, one of the greatest of all time, talking just on and on and on about Skandor Akbar, and you know, that really made an impression on me, and that meant a lot to me too, you know. And I told Ack about it when we went back home, and he, you know, that big smile come on his face.
You know, James, Ack was one of the first guys to bench press 500 pounds.
Yeah.
50 pounds. I mean, he was legit, man. We had so much fun because when I broke in, I rode with you because we were close proximity to each other here in Texas. And we'd go by and pick up Ack. And it was Stone Cold Steve Austin talks about riding with Ack, about how it's like a Harvard class.
So many guys do.
Wrestling. And I rode with you guys for a couple of years. Just like I say, thousands and thousands. Not near as many as you did. But what a wonderful experience. Tell a story about Ack in Wilbarger County growing up, Wichita Falls, and the guy he got in a fight with and why he had to join the military, if you remember the story.
I don't remember that story. Vaguely, but maybe.
So here's what happened, Jerry, was that Ack, I found out from Dick Murdoch, Ack was getting picked on because he's Lebanese. and they're picking on him. He was born in what? Born in Wichita, grew up in Vernon, or vice versa.
Vernon, Texas. Yeah. Vernon, Texas. Yeah.
Right up 287. And so the Act invites the guy out to fight. So they drive out together in the country. Act breaks both of his legs. He showed me, he put it in figure four. And
yeah, I remember that vaguely now, yeah.
And Act drove the guy to the hospital and put him off. So the sheriff comes to Act, and he's like, dude, they want to almost hang you. They're so mad at you. And he said, I understand it was a fair fight. He goes, the one thing I can offer you, if you'll join the military, I don't have to press charges. And so that's how Ack ended up serving the country and ended up in Germany in the military and then came back and got into professional wrestling.
I've never heard that story before, and I know a lot about Akbar. The worst thing I know about Akbar is he was a OU football historian. A guy could tell you every statistic in football. Every, yeah. It was OU, wasn't Texas, but he was OU. He was like our friend Jim Ross for being fanatical on that OU football. I can only imagine a boring ass ride that him and Jim Ross had OU football from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Shreveport, Louisiana. That had to be an interesting ride. He still holds the record, which he does, by the way, for the longest quick kick in OU football history. Did you know that, John? 98 yards. He's got the still holds the record for a quick kick in OU football. You can look it up. Go to Mr. Google. Mr. Google will tell you.
I'll tell you, act.
You know, the thing about that is, what was OU doing at their own 2-yard line?
And he's probably playing Oklahoma State.
Bingo. No wonder you got the punt.
Act got a lot of joy out of giving Jim Ross hell about OU football.
Oh, did he ever. Called him Hammer and
almost,
Ross.
Almost as much as Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes.
And Layfield.
They live.
Don't forget to throw Layfield in there either. Yeah. I mean, it was always great on Mondays, you know, when during football season, especially that OU Texas weekend, if Texas got lucky and won the coin toss, they didn't have to win the game, but if they won the coin toss, Layfield would rub that in Jim Ross. Tell Jim Ross was so frustrated he won't throw his cowboy hat down and stop it, man.
He used to love to tell the story about Murdoch and Rhodes. One of the years Texas got up on OU pretty heavy. But halftime, they were way ahead. They snuck over to the other side and found Bill Watts and just gave him hell for the whole second half. And Act thought that was the funniest thing, you know, but he knew everything you could think about college and high school football. Let me tell you, he was an expert at that.
There wasn't a time that Oklahoma didn't lose that Akbar wouldn't say, call Jim Ross. Call Jim Ross.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought it was the greatest thing ever. There's such a great rivalry between the country of Texas and the state of Oklahoma.
Well, Jerry, you talk about riding with Akbar and learning. Let me tell you a story about this guy. We're riding to somewhere in West Texas.
I hope you don't say you learned anything from him because
no.
I'd have to call you out of your car.
He wasn't talking. He was in the car with Akbar and Killer Tim Brooks and myself.
Yeah.
So we're going out to interstate.
That's a car.
We stop at this place. I'm gonna get this right too. We stop at this place to get some gas and they had one of these filling stations that sold chicken, fried chicken and stuff, you know, and so we're all in there and somebody said something about getting something to eat. And John said, I'll get a bucket of chicken. So we're going, okay. We all get back in the car. We go down the road about 5 or 10 miles and Killer says, Hey kid, you're talking to John. He said, kid, why don't you pass me some of that chicken? John said, there's none left. He had eaten a whole bucket of chicken in 10 miles.
The day Killer died, he would tell me about that fried chicken. I'd love that piece of fried chicken. I just want a piece of it.
Yeah. Last thing he told me, we were talking to John. I got to spend a little time with Killer before he died. Several times I went to visit him a few times, and he would talk about John. He'd say, tell John, send me that chicken. Never fail.
Hey, what an underrated talent he was. I mean, you just, you know, he was kind of stuck in that one area there. But, man, Brooke Keller Brooks was an underrated talent and one of the best guys ever in step in that squared circle.
He was so believable. That was the thing.
He made the, you know, that old Johnny Valentine deal. I don't care what happened, when I get out there, you're going to believe what I'm doing.
He was believable if you're across from him, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, we were good friends, but, you know, I'd get in the ring with him sometime, and then he'd come at me, and I'd be thinking, you know, he looks awfully serious about this. Yeah, I remember I tell this story sometimes. He was working with some young guy, and he had him across the rope, choking him, and I was trying to get him to break, you know, and doing everything I could, and Killer says, pull me back by my ear, and I'm thinking, no, I'm not doing that, because if I do that, he's gonna kill me. So I'd keep patting him on the back, break a hold, you know, and he said, pull me back by my ear. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try this. So I grabbed him and I just kind of worked it back like this. And he spun around, started coming at me. And I just pointed at my referee shirt and he stopped. and it backed off, you know. And after it was over with, I said, I thought you were going to kill me. And he said, no, he said, it got me over, got you over. Got me over as being a heel that just hard to control, got you as a referee that could control me. So I learned a lesson there too.
What an important lesson you learned.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, those old time hills, they could teach you so much without you even knowing it.
Yeah. You know, the thought was, I don't want to bury him by pulling him back by his ear, but he looked at it a whole different way. It was like, no, that just makes me hard to control.
James, I'll tell you a funny story about the first time I met one of the dirt sheet guys, you know, in Dallas. And I don't know where I met. I met him I forget where it was. But anyway, he's telling me about Killer Tim Brooks. And this is the difference in heat and real heat, you know, and heels that fans like. So he goes, man, I can't stand that Killer Tim Brooks. And the first time I'd ever heard the term work rate, he goes, his work rate's terrible. I'd never even heard that term. And I'm like, what? I have no idea what you're talking about. And I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, he's just terrible. His matches are awful. He's just no good. And I said, let me ask you a question. If Stan Hansen were to come in to fight Killer Tim Brooks, would you go to see it? And he goes, I'd pay double. I said, you're right. He's not a good worker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, point.
Good point.
And that killer could get heat, man. He could get heat in a freaking refrigerator. He was so good.
Absolutely.
He tagged with Brody, didn't he, in Japan?
Yes, he did. Yeah. And now that's another story. I can't ever get it exactly right, but there was a time when Brody was going to switching from Baba to Anoki or the other way around, one way or the other. And, you know, he did it twice. He did it one time.
There's a lot of switching going on back
then. Yeah. Yeah. He did it with Snuka one time, and he did it with Killer one time. He refused to go out and do it to work. You know, and they finally got in the ring. They finally somehow they got it all negotiated, and Killer was a part of that. And he said he was pretty nervous for a while, but they, you know how Brody could be, and they got through it some way or the other. And then Brody took off, you know, got his money.
James, you're talking about unpredictability. Did you ever have a match that just got totally out of line where you just had no control? I mean, not a working match, but, you know, just two guys going at it like over in Japan or even some little damn wild-ass Texas towns. I've seen a few of them, but tell us about the one.
Well, it was always that way when you got into it. You start working with guys. You're talking about Brody and Abby. My first night in the business, Brody had a lot to do with me getting in the business. And basically, he said, "Just follow us around," and that's what I tried to do, you know. And that's how I broke in, you know. And that was totally. I felt totally out of control, you know, with those two guys. And you know, we had some matches that were set up that were almost like, I remember a match with John and Black Bart in the Sportatorium. We had a Falls Count Anywhere with the Romero brothers, Mark and Chris. And then I chased them all over the place. I mean, they went all over the building, everywhere you could go. And you know, I was like going running over here, trying to make a count, and running over there, trying to make a count. And they had a little tower by the ring at Sportatorium where they'd have a hard camera sometimes, or our cameraman would go up there sometimes and handheld. And Bart ended up going up there with Chris. They were on his and it was shaking and doing this kind of thing, you know, and going back and forth. And Bart said, "Ain't you gonna come up here and count?" And I said, "You get your fat ass down from there, I'll count, but I'm not coming up there."
Bart got up there and couldn't figure out how to get down.
Yeah,
it was great. That's
exactly what happened. Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought we were going to send a pillow up there and breakfast.
there's another character for you right there. That Black Bart is something else, man.
Yeah, no kidding. He's another guy. There were so many of those guys like that are just under the radar, you know, for some reason. You know, our business is full of those guys, and our business wouldn't be what it is today without guys like Black Bart and Keller Brooks and, you know, guys like that.
People ask me all the time, who are your favorite people to work with? And, you know, they expect you to talk about the big stars, the big names and that kind of thing. But I always say I like working with what some people call the carpenters or the technicians or however you want to put it. But the guys that really had those skills, they could work with anybody that you knew their match was going to be solid. It was going to make sense, you know, and they knew how to work with you. Those are the guys that I enjoyed working with.
You know, guys like me and even John who come in during the right time, we were so blessed to have so many of those type guys around, you know, that would share their knowledge with you. And like we opened up this show with, just sit in the back seat and listen to them. All you had to do is sit in there. If you wanted to learn, sit in that dressing room and listen to them talk back and forth. Then they take you out to the ring and they show you, they put you step by step, and you don't even know you're doing that step by step until you get out of that ring and all of a sudden, man, what did I do in there? You know, well, that guy over there led me all the way through the damn thing. It was a thankless job. And, you know, the Juan Sebastians, the Frank Morels, and Johnny Heidelmans, and the guys like that. I mean, without those guys, there'd be no superstars in the business.
Absolutely. And so there were so many of them too that, you know, that don't get those accolades that they should get, you know, and the appreciation that you get a lot. You know, I know a lot of guys who made it big stars and they don't even realize that those guys put them in the place that, like you're talking about, they actually just put you in those places to succeed, even in a match or whatever. And some guys don't even understand that that's what happened to them. That's how they got there.
Uh-huh. James, who was it? The always rumor was it was Bronco Lubitsch, and I don't think it was. I got to work with Bronco, but they always talk about Bronco counting three with his foot toward the end of when you have all these false minutes. But I always heard it was Bulldog Danny Pletches. So who was it that would actually, when you do false finish after false finish, the referee who wouldn't get even just start counting with his foot? Was it Bronco or Danny?
Danny was another one. They used to take a lot of old wrestlers and guys that retired that, and some of them were all beat up and everything, and they couldn't bend down, couldn't get down or whatever, and make referees out of them. Some of them were pretty good. You know, Bronco technically wasn't a great referee, but he had so much respect that he was effective. But he was broken up too. He would get down on one knee and hold on to the rope and count.
That's right. You
know? Yeah. I never actually, the rumors are around that he'd count with his feet. I don't know that I ever remember him actually doing that, but he.
My brother told me one time it was Danny Pletches actually did it. One of my brother's matches when he first started in the business, he was in some little spot show there, and Jack had just left Oklahoma and think he was going to big time wrestling down in Texas, you know, and it was big time for down there, and so they were in one of those little towns, and Jack said he had somebody covered, and the referee. Danny just count 1, 2, 3. Get up, kid. You win. So get up so I can raise your hand.
Yeah,
that sounds he said, right. I just counted.
Yeah.
But I saw Sonny Myers do that several times down here in Florida. They, like you said, you know, a lot of the promoters felt loyal to some of the old timers that made them money. So that was their way of taking care of the talent that took care of them, you know, when they were able to do it in the ring was by making them a referee. And some of them couldn't get up and down. Some of them couldn't lace their damn boots. You had to tie their shoestrings for them because they were so beat up. And those old rings, you know, I'd like to tell people, you know, when did you start? Well, I started in the mid-60s. the rings. Well, the rings were those old, as you guys know, they were all of that sportatorium probably had. It was those old boxing, stiff-ass, solid iron metal rings that had no give in them, nowhere on in the ring where could you find a soft spot to land, you know. So those old-timers, they took those bumps on those hard-ass rings. There were no cushions on a on the outside. You got thrown over that rope. It was 15 foot to that concrete floor. It was a thud when you landed on it.
Yeah, well, the ring at the Sportatorium was actually used as a stage for music, because on Saturday nights, they had what they called the Big D Jamboree, which was a televised country music show. And they would take the ropes down. You could still see the ring posts on TV, but the ropes were down, and they used that as a stage for music. It was as hard as a brick bat. That thing was 22 feet.
Yeah, 22 feet crisscrossing on those. You didn't get a lot of crisscrossing back then. Oh, I remember the first time I worked in a 22-foot ring was in St. Louis. I'd take my step, you know, you get that 3.5. Man, where's the damn ropes at? Yeah. You still got 3 more to go.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people get in there the first time at the Sportatorium, and they go like, man, I can't run across these ropes, and it feels like I'm falling on a concrete floor, you know, and that's the way it was there. But you're right, Phil. The old guys, you know, Dick Rains was a referee in Dallas for a long time, and you know, he was an old timer, and Danny Plaitchis, and of course Bronco later on, and those are some more guys that I learned from right there, you know, that not just so much about refereeing, but just about wrestling.
James, you know, Agbar used to always talk about Harley Race, and he loved Harley Race. He really looked at him, but he said Harley Race was the only guy tough enough to bump in the keel in St. Louis. And I told Harley that one day, and he was on a cane. He goes, "That's why I'm on a cane now." And literally, James, how many times did you have some fat person walk by you, and Skandar Akbar would call him Mr. or Mrs. Beard? Every fat person that walked by, he goes,
"Every match.
There's Mrs. Layfield. Hey, Mr. Layfield, can I?" It's just
he would find he'd find the fattest, ugliest girl that he could find sitting on the front row, and that would be Mrs. Beard or Mrs. Layfield or whoever he was after at the time. Yeah, but that and that damn crop. I've got permanent injury on my ankle from that crop.
James, I'll tell you a funny story about that, because I worked with Black Bart, and I love Bart. Bart's he meant so much to me, still does. But Bart is waffling me. I mean, waffling me. That's pretty unusual for Bart. He was a really good worker. Finally, he goes, "That's a receipt, damn it." I don't know what a receipt is. So I roll out of the ring, and I ask Ack. I said, "Ack, you know, it's the wrong guy to ask." And I said, "What's a receipt?" He goes, "That means that Bart loves it. He wants you to give him a receipt for that back." I got it. So I go back in there, and Bart wobbles me, and I go, "Okay, I got to hit him back." Wham! I go, "It's a receipt, you idiot!"
Jerry, let me tell you, we John had been there a little while, and Bobby Duncombe Jr. came in. Bobby was like a wild bronc. I mean, he was chasing that quarterback even in the wrestling ring all the time. You know, so we tried to get him to settle down, just impossible to do. So we put these two guys together as a tag team. I even took them to Japan. I don't know how I got talked into that, but so we put these two guys together, and the first time Johnny Mantell and Bart were tagging together against these two guys, Johnny started the match, and he tied up with Bobby and powdered. As soon as he tied up with Bobby, he's just powdered, and he's sitting there with his head on the apron like this. And I said, "Get back in the ring." He said, "Nope, I'm not getting back in the ring." He tried to tag Bart from the outside, and I said, "I'm not going to let you do that. You got to get in the ring." Well, we argued for about 2 or 3 minutes there about that. We're going back and forth and stuff. Finally, he rolled in and tagged Bart and rolled right back out again. But that's the kind of guys these were when they first started out. It was like a couple of Broncos out there.
And I can only imagine. I've never had the pleasure of meeting Bobby Jr. I would, you know, travel up and down the road in several different territories with Senior, and what a great guy, and what a great loss, and even bigger loss at such an early age when Junior left us. But always wanted to see him, just see him perform, because I had such great respect for his old man and how good he was and everything. But
he was a great natural athlete.
Yeah.
And he probably could have been a great wrestler, you know, if it had already gotten applied the way it needed to. But he just needed to settle down. You know, we when I took him to Japan, I think the first night we were over there in Kerrigan Hall, I don't even remember who Bobby was up against or whatever, but he did something to a guy that I've never seen it before, and I've never seen it since. I thought he was going to break his neck. And so Bobby comes out of the ring, and he called it the Dunk'em Dog. He said he like did it on purpose. You know, so Bobby, can you show us how you did that? No, can't show us a secret.
But it was so wild. You know what happened with Bobby was Bobby went back and started playing arena football. You know, we were tagging, and we were getting some interest in going some different places. And then Bobby decided to go back and play arena football. And after that, he had like six surgeries in the next year because he got hurt and blew out his shoulder to play football. And that really set him back. Bobby was a good hand and a wonderful person.
Yes, he was. Yeah, great guy. Super guy.
And James, question for you on wrestling in about 86. Okay. Now, Michael Hayes. I talked to Michael Hayes, and he would not give me an answer. So I don't know if you know the truth or not. Gino Hernandez, was that a murder? What did you hear from the boys tonight? Because I asked Michael about it, and Michael said, well, I can tell you this. It wasn't an overdose. I said, this was a murder. He goes, I'm not saying that. I said, well, you're saying it wasn't an overdose. I said, did he kill himself? He said, no. I said, the only other option is murder. So do you think somebody knocked off Gino Hernandez?
Well, you know, obviously I don't know, but there's so many things about that whole situation that were really fishy. Gino was he lived the life, you know, he what you saw in the ring, that was Gino. He was a little out of hand when it came to that. But what a lot of people don't know about Gino is that even though he did things and partied and had a good time, you hardly ever saw him unimpaired. I mean, he was generally had his senses about him. So the fact that he would do that much of something is kind of odd. That's out of character.
That's what Michael did.
Yeah. And you know, and the way it all went down, there's a lot of suspicious things about that situation that make you wonder, you know, what really happened. You know, like I said, obviously there's no way you can know, but I have my doubts about it being an accident.
Yeah. During that time, James, say from 84 to 86, you started 85, right in the middle of that. You had WrestleMania started. You had the five territories in Texas from the Funks in Amarillo, Joe Blanchard in San Antonio, Guerrero's in El Paso and Bosch in Houston, of course, Fritz in Dallas. Did you see – you had ESPN – that just got started with AWA. He had WTBS, which started first with Joe Blanchard and then Vince on USA Network. So it was coming. The wave was coming. Yeah. Did you guys know it then? And I'd heard that Fritz had a talk with Vince. And I talked to some people that said, not sure if it happened or not. Was there ever talks between Fritz and Vince about somehow combining forces?
I've been told by people who should have known and were there, Akbar being one of them, that they discussed some kind of cooperative situation. I don't know. I don't know if it was like a partnership or like some kind of cooperative situation for them, because at the time, World Class was really pretty hard to take over. You know, I can remember a few times when Vince first came to Dallas and they would be at Reunion Arena. We'd be at the Sportatorium and outdraw them, you know, right. and it really didn't break through in Texas until he got Kerry involved and Fritz involved, you know, to some degree, or at least they had them on board with them in some way. But I don't know. I mean, who knows exactly what the talks were. But
someone was behind it that he wanted Kerry.
I think that was that's the story that was a big part of it. He was, from what I understand, Vince was a big fan of Kerry's.
That's the story I always heard too, guys. That Vince wanted Kerry, and that's the only thing he really wanted out of the territory, because he knew he could come in eventually and have the stroke there. But Kerry was the key to it the whole time.
Yeah,
that's the story I always heard.
Yeah, and that very well may be the whole thing. It may be the whole deal. I don't know. World Class was pretty strong there for a while. And it was a tough nut for Vince to crack down here. And he finally broke through, of course, after he did get Kerry involved. But it was a struggle for him for a while.
In 86, Fritz dropped out of the NWA to try to go global. And what I'd heard was that maybe that David and his boys had kind of pitched him to go global earlier. He didn't want to do it. Did you guys know at that time that it was probably a zero-sum game, that either you made it big or you were going to be go head into the tar pit?
I don't think anybody really understood the whole, degree of importance of doing something like that at the time. Fritz was just like all the other territory guys. They didn't want to step on anybody else's stuff and cause a ruckus and that kind of thing among all those guys. And I think that was his hesitation in doing something like that. They had a leg up to do it, because they had great TV, great syndication. Probably could have had if the right situation come along when the cable thing started, they probably could have had a shot at that too. You know, I don't know. So many things changed in Dallas after David died, though. You know, when David died, I think the leadership of the company was always going to kind of be flapping out there in the wind a little bit, because he was the only one of the boys that had the business sense to handle things. Jerry was around him in Florida, and the stories we hear is that, he was being groomed a little bit to be something bigger.
Well, that's absolutely right, James. I mean, we had him down there. Of course, Eddie and Fritz went way back. So they, as you said earlier, there was always exchange of talent between Fritz and Eddie. But David come down, and when David come down, we were told, we being my brother and I and Dusty and a couple other guys that were up there a little bit in partnership, but this guy's being groomed, so we've got to really take care of David down here. And you're right. I mean, all the Von Erichs I passed by and worked with, David had the most business sense and the most logical and the most down to earth guy that you'd ever want to meet. But he was next in line. He was one that was touched and getting ready to make that next step. And there was never any doubt when he left Florida that this kid could carry the ball.
Yeah, he was a special guy in a lot of ways, in and out of the ring. I think had he lived, who knows what might have happened in Dallas. A lot of things could have changed. As far as the situation with Vince goes, though, who knows? You just don't know what was going on behind the scenes for sure. But I have been told that there was some talking going on anyway.
After that, you had USA step in and USWA step in, which, Kevin has said he didn't really like. And apparently Jerry didn't really like him. So, it was mutual. So,
yeah.
Were you were going to Japan back and forth at that time, but
yeah, thank God. Uh-huh. Yeah. I was working there when I was home, so I'd be in Japan sometimes 6 or 8 weeks at a time. And when I come home, I'd do TV there at the Sportatorium when all that happened and all. It was a weird situation, the whole thing, because, you know, Memphis was such a different style than what we were used to in Dallas. The way it was run, the whole thing. And it's, I'm not saying anything bad about it one way or the other. It's just different, you know.
Well, James, what to do? Memphis was still an old traditional run style territory with old traditional values and traditional matches and things like that, where Dallas had already been touched by world-class TV. You guys were the progressive ones. You guys were the ones way out there that Memphis kind of looked at. What the hell are they doing there? You know, we need to reel them back in, when in real life, Memphis needed to step
up. People thought hardcore was invented in the mid-90s with ECW. It wasn't. It was, it was invented in several places before, but one place was that sport on Katie's and Industrial.
The Texas Death Matches, those were the original hardcore matches.
There were chairs over the head. I mean, it was blood every night. It was a rough
place to work. It was crazy. Yeah, no question about that. Yeah, it was a different world. But yeah, the when USWA came in, it was an odd situation for us there. You know, with some of the talent from world class were still around, and you know, and then they brought that influx of guys in. You know, with Lawler and Jeff Jarrett and Dundee and Dutch and all those guys. You know, and it's just different. You know,
the fans had to take a dump on that style after seeing those young stallion that you guys had in there, Freebirds, Devon Eric, and Chris Adams, and all those guys like that, the Genos, and then all of a sudden be hit with no knock on my brother Jerry the King and Dundee and those guys like that. But man, it was night and day. It was like a green light and a red light. Yep. You know, and Memphis was at a green light, a red light, and Dallas was that green light where it pedaled to the metal, man.
It was a hard sell for the fans there. It really was. Coming, but when I'd come back home from Japan, you know, it was just like being in a foreign country almost at the sportatorium. Everything was different. You know, we didn't have anybody in world class like USWA had with Jerry, you know, with Lawler. You know, the having a talent being so influential in the whole thing too, that was part of it. And it was just odd situation for us.
James, I tried to look for it on YouTube, but I couldn't find it. You had a wrestling match with a mutual friend of me and Mr. Briscoe's, and that's Brother Love, Bruce Prichard.
I hope you never find it.
I'd love to see that, John. I'll pay you to find it.
Do you think that by any chance that's what killed USWA?
Well, no, Bruce Prichard
killed USWA.
It had the possibility of killing any territory, but it actually happened.
So we got you on record, James, to say Brother Love, Bruce Prichard killed a territory.
That's right.
Yeah.
Brother Love, Bruce Prichard killed USWA.
It actually happened in Global. To be honest with you, this was after USWA had left. Kevin actually came back in and tried to run for a little while. TV was gone, and it just was impossible. And plus, Kevin's not the business guy, you know, to run a company.
He killed Global and USWA.
Yeah, both. Yeah.
They killed two territories.
Went back in time and killed USWA. but to be honest with you, that was Eddie Gilbert's fault, because he came up with the idea. He came to me and he said, I want you to quit refereeing for a few weeks and have wrestling matches with Bruce. And I'm like, what?
That was probably Bruce's ideal, though. Bruce's ideal.
Yeah, it could be. I can blame him. That'd be okay with me. But
invented the headlock. Bruce Prichard invented the headlock. He even gave Ed Stringer Lewis that man.
Oh, yeah.
The way you get that thing over is walk around and squeeze that man. Well, nobody else.
Let's listen to his podcast. He's invented everything.
Yeah. Let me tell you how this started. No, Bruce had been working for Vince, and whatever happened, and he left for a while.
He's been fired a couple times.
Yeah, well, he got fired.
Anyway, so he starts working with us, and he was managing. Mike Davis, I think, and maybe a couple other guys. Dark Patriot, Doug Gilbert, and had a battle royal, and I was outside in the battle royal. And the gimmick was, is that his guy, he was going to jump up on the apron at some point, and I'm going to reach up and pull him down. But when I reached up and pulled him down, I pulled his pants down.
And you said Bruce jump up on something.
Well, he climbed up on something. He crawled up on the apron.
Okay.
And it was a long match, Jerry.
Yeah. And stood up. And I reached up and grabbed him. And when I did, I pulled him down. And all he had on was a thong.
No!
That was, man. That was the most horrible sight I've ever seen in my life. And I was this far from it.
Oh, my
God. Oh, yeah. That should have killed the angle right there. But anyway. Yeah, well, you know, so after the battle royal, I'm laughing at him and I'm walking off and his guys attack me and they, you know, and all, that's what started it all. So Bruce and I had a boxing match and or two or three wrestling matches with Eddie and Terry Garvin or Terry Sims. And they were my partners. And then Mike Davis and Doug and Bruce on the other side. And we had several of those, and Bill Irwin actually refereed the blow-off match. And the blow-off match was somebody had to pull somebody's pants down, right? Naturally. This is a Memphis thing. You know how that Eddie thinks sometimes, you know. And thank God, I almost would have taken mine off without having to pull his down and look at it again, but I did win it.
did he have a thong on again?
Of course.
Does he always wear a thong?
Well, that makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes you wonder.
As long as I've known him,
where did he get an extra large thong? He's been around that booty of his.
You may still have those thongs. You might want to ask him about that.
As Terry Funk would say, Bruce Prichard, you have childbearing hips.
That's great. I looked all morning for that match. I couldn't find it.
Yeah, well, so obviously, I'm hoping you never find it.
Hey, a couple of weeks ago, we had Hornswoggle on. There was this impossible tape, you know, we had about the chicken and the Hornswoggle.
Yeah.
And that guy up in the corner there actually traced it down and got permission from the WWE, from the Empire. Right. To air it on Briscoe and Bradshaw's show.
Oh, wow.
And so you better be careful what you wish for. We'll find that out there. If it exists,
yeah.
If it exists, John will
find
footage
of Bruce and I hope they don't allow anybody to show
it. If it exists, we're
going to probably get our account suspended from Twitter.
Quite possible. And I had to go back to Japan after that because all you guys over taking pictures of this, right? You know, and then, you know how it is over there. They know what happens over here. So
there is some pictures out there, what you're saying then, right? There would be some, even if there's no footage, there's got to be some pictures of those Japanese guys.
Yeah, I'm afraid so, yeah.
We're going on a hunt. So James, before you go, I want to ask you a little about Japan. When you started in Japan, you started with Tenru, right?
Yep.
And that was the split of Inoki and Tenru, and yep. Tenru was working with.
Well, it was actually Baba and Tenru.
Oh, Baba and Tenru. I'm sorry. Yep. All Japan. Yeah. Japan. So Baba and Tenru split. That's right. Yeah. I'm sorry. Of course.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then Tenru was also working with WWE at the time, right?
Actually, when it first started, they opened the company up, and when Sakurada. Kendo Nagasaki, Sakurada, you know, however you know him, he asked me to go over there. They were going to have a two-night opening deal with in Yokohama, and big ceremony, the big deal. It had like 17,000 people two nights in a row in that arena, and the whole idea of that company was to be a strong style, and that was the philosophy. What happened at some point, I don't know why Tenyu wanted to work with Vince, but some reason, I mean, obviously the connection and the publicity and all was a big deal. But anyway, he made that deal with them, and that caused a lot of friction inside the SWE company. A lot of the traditional Japanese guys didn't like the deal because they thought that what Vince was doing at the time on TV was totally opposite of what the philosophy of the company was supposed to be. And that caused a lot of infighting. And eventually that company split because of that too. And that's when Sakurada took his part and obviously, you know, and I was helping book that, and that's when I brought you over. So there was a lot of, you know how the politics go over there, the same as it is over here, you know.
And thank goodness you put me with Bob Orton that first tour as a tag partner, so I was able to get through it.
Bob, you know, I think I told you this story, but the first time I went to Japan, Bob was on the tour, and then they weren't taking, when the first several tours over there, it wasn't involving with Vince's group, with the WWE AF at the time. They were bringing some of the top guys from the States over in different places, and Bob was one of them. And so we're over there, and we get there, and you know how it is in Japan when you get there late, you're tired, you know, you want to crash. Everybody goes to their room. Well, they put us in this place in a kind of a residential area, and Bob's first thought was, he said, yeah, they put us here because they don't want us to get in trouble, and it's probably right because there wasn't anything around there. I mean, nothing, no clubs, no nothing. Well, we get there and everybody gets in a room, and Bob comes to my room and he knocks on the door. He says, come on, you go with me. And I'm going like, man, I'm tired. He said, trust me, go with me. If you don't go with me, you're going to wake up about 2 o'clock in the morning. You're going to hate yourself. I said, okay. So we went and knocked on everybody's door and they all crashed. They didn't want to go with us. I said, I'm going to go with a guy that I learned by then to listen to the veteran, right? You know, so we take off and we're going to walking around. We found a place. We stop. We may drink a beer or two, and they cut us off. Said we're closing like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. You know, Bob said, "Oh man, they really did it to us this time." So he said, "Come on." So we go walking around. And we find this tunnel. I mean, like down underneath the street almost. And there's this club, and you walk in there, and there's all these Japanese businessmen there, and half of them don't have fingers, you know, they're like this. and I'm thinking, man, I don't know if I want to be here or not. But we walk in, and this host comes up to us, and she says, we want to help you. And Bob says, okay, yeah, we're going to spend 6,000 yen. That's it. 6,000. Okay. So they set us down. And of course, we're sitting there for about an hour or so. and Bob looks at me and he said, I think we've probably overdone the 6,000 yen. And he said, so we probably ought to leave. And I said, okay, I'm just following you. I didn't even know what a yen was at the time. And so the girl comes over. She said, okay, your bill's 12,000 yen. Uh-huh. Bob says, no. I told you I'm spending 6,000 yen. That's all I'm spending. That's it. You know how Bob could be. He just, that gruff voice and everything. The girl goes, but you spend 12,000. Bob said, I don't care how much I spent. 6,000, that's all you're getting. Well, she runs off and gets the manager of the club. He comes down there and he tells, he knew who Bob was for some reason. You know, I guess they'd seen him over there on TV or something. He said, Mr. Orton, 12,000 yen, please. Nope. I told you 6,000 yen, that's all I'm spending. Told the girl that. The guy goes on back and forth. And finally Bob said, okay, I'll tell you what. And it's just kind of getting loud. You can see all these guys over there watching us, you know, and looking at us, and they're all real dead serious. And I'm like, man, I want to get out of here alive, you know, somehow. And Bob said, I'll give you 12,000 yen, but when I give it to you, I'm going to squeeze your head like a grape. And the guy goes, no, Mr. Orton, 6,000, okay. Well, Bob gives him 6,000 yen, and all these guys start laughing. And I'm like, thank God. Bob Orton stories, and I'm finally a part of one, you know, and I hope I live through it.
I don't think I've ever told this story. I don't know if you were there for the memorial service, but one time we were in Japan working for Kendo Nagasaki, Mr. Sakurada, and we're on the volcanic springs on the westerly side of Honshu across the island. And we go down there and we have a drink or something after the last match. And a couple Japanese guys come in and have sit with us for a while and in a big hotel volcanic pool. And then they leave. And then if you remember on the way back, those Japanese.
Yeah, that was guys, the hotel underneath. They had the hot springs underneath there, right?
That's right. The whole thing was
hot springs. Yeah, I was there. So, yeah.
We get back to Narita, Jerry, and the office all comes up, and they're very serious about something. And I don't know what it is, but they're not telling us, so it's none of my business. So we get on the plane and go back. Then I find out that on the way back, one of these young guys was driving the ring truck, had a wreck, and died on the way back to Tokyo. So I found that out when I was back in Texas. So I realized I've got one of the last pictures, or the last picture of this kid alive. So wow. I developed a picture, and I sent it to Mr. Sakurada in the Japanese office. I said, hey, please give this to the family. I wrote him a nice little note. Just want to let you know, last night your son was having a great time, and he seemed like a great young man. And I sent him a picture. Never heard a word back. So we go the next tour, and Mr. Sakurada, Kendo, grabs me and says, we got to go. So I assume we're going with sponsors. We go to this place where everybody's dressed up, and there's a picture of this young man. And it's a memorial service for this young man. They have me speaking at wow. this memorial service.
And I remember that, yeah.
I tell Kendo, I said, Kendo, I didn't know him. I don't even know his full name. I said, I just took a picture, and it was the last picture, so I sent it to him. And I said, I can't give you eulogy. I said, he seemed like a great guy, but I don't know him. And Kendo says, it's okay. Nobody speaks English. So I get up and give a eulogy for this young guy. And everybody's like,
oh,
I didn't know him. I didn't even know his full name. I'd seen him that night, took a picture. I knew I saw him around, but that was it. His family all came up and said, thank you so much. They thought I was one of his best friends or something. I don't know. What do I do?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. Yeah. The kid was pulling the ring truck and our part of the ring crew and one of the young boys that we were training also.
That's right. Yeah. And I ended up giving a eulogy at his wake and I didn't know it until I got there. So I just got up there and just acted like I was talking about somebody that I knew very well and told generic, you know, like he was a guy, great, all this stuff. I thought nobody understands me anyway. And everybody they were so thankful afterwards. Oh my goodness. What just happened?
Wow. James, we had Orton on last week or a couple of weeks ago, and we have tried to get the story out of him where he was barred from that one island in Japan and had to leave him behind for 3 days while they went over there and worked. And John was on one of those tours, and yeah. Bobby conveniently couldn't recall the situation there.
Well, whatever happened to cause him to be barred from that place happened when he was working for a different company. But evidently it didn't change when he went to work with us. So he was, we had to drop him off. He couldn't get him and go with us. Evidently Bob had a lot of fun in Japan.
He's a lot of fun anywhere.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a story we got up, and Jerry has a picture of it, where he and Terry Funk terrorized a fishing village one time with a motorcycle they got from a junkyard. So,
I've heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah. We rebuilt two motorcycles, and it cost us $50 a piece, and we terrorized. We got shut down by the police one night and threatened to get it taken to jail the next day if we didn't surrender our motorcycles. I got a picture of Terry's helmet. He actually had a helmet on. He found an old war helmet in that junkyard, and he wore the helmet. Briscoe, I'm safe, and you're going to have brain damage, but he's the one that ended up
with it. What a character he is. You know,
what a partner to have in Japan. I mean,
I can imagine, yes. Yeah.
But, James, I want to thank you for coming on here, man. It's been fun. It's been a quick show. I look forward to seeing you in July and
absolutely.
I'm having our critique, our camp there, our evaluation camp. We're going to have a record amount of people there. So look forward to seeing you at the Dan Gable Museum at the Thais Trigas Hall
absolutely.
Of Fame. By the way, Mr. Layfield's a member of also. He's a member of so many Hall of Fame here, you know.
Oh, stop
you
it.
You can't name all of them.
You're the one that put me in and then hacked my phone. He did.
Just to plug that though, that's one of the greatest experiences though to go to that. It's such a wonderful situation, and the whole atmosphere is just really pleasant and professional, and I loved it there. You know,
Coach Gable gets right involved. I mean, you would think he was part of a professional family, which he is. I mean, he's so welcoming me there. I mean, he's a first class gentleman there, and all the guys that go there, one of the first things they want to meet. See and meet is Dan Gable. I mean,
yeah,
Dan's the same. If somebody comes in, you know. he has grandkids and kids. They all grew up watching professional wrestling, sure. So he don't try to hide. I mean, he, you know, he respects what we do, and you know, somebody there that he one of his grandkids, he's gonna get an autograph for his grandkids. So
he's
it's
cool.
It's really cool how the two worlds blend and combine there. Yes. And, like I said, John came up and made a couple of big announcements while he was there.
Too long to go into. It was a bad night. It was a Briscoe night in Brisket. Oh my goodness! If I live to be 1,000, I will never get him back good enough for what he did to me in Waterloo, Iowa. I promise. I could live 400 lifetimes and not get him back. And it would.
Some it people awesome. Just can't get
the
over.
The only thing I regret was I didn't think of it to do it to him. Hey James, another it's about plugging stuff. Tell us about what you're doing now before you go, but with SWE and what's going on, how you can watch all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, we started SWE a couple of years ago now, and it's really grown in the last 2 years, and gotten to a point to where we're on I don't know how many streaming services and broadcast stations now, and we're drawing big crowds. We're trying to do things the way we used to do them. It's something I think that both you guys would appreciate, and it's still a growing process right now for us, but we're very passionate about doing it the way we're doing it, and we've got some good people working with us. You know, I do the TV, to write the TV with Teddy Long, who's good friend of yours, and
yes.
and Kevin Sullivan, we all kind of get our heads together and put it together, and it's been a real pleasure. And I did it by myself the first year, you know, and been working with those guys since then, and really enjoying the experience. And we're making some strides right now. We're hoping that after this COVID thing is kind of out of the way, that things will break loose for us, and so far so good.
That's awesome, James. Good for you. Still in the business, still doing great things.
No, trying, yeah.
Well, James, I love you. You've been a great friend ever since the first day I met you at the Sportatorium, and it's always great to see you. Thanks for coming on with me and Mr. Briscoe, my Okie friend. It's good to have two Texans against one Oklahomian.
Well, I don't know how we came out on that, but we'll it's been a pleasure. I enjoyed it. I always is. You know, I love you too. And Jerry, I got so much respect for Jerry. You know, that just a wonderful guy, you know, even if he is from Oklahoma. it's always a pleasure to be around him. And that's another learning experience for me, you know. And I appreciate you guys having me on.